Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, your site for conversations about the cultures of consciousness. As I plunge further towards the deadline of my seemingly endless academic project, my dissertation, I've been wrestling with the curious question of voices in the head. Now, in some sense, hearing a voice in your head that isn't your own is almost like the kind of most classic boiled down situation of some kind of psychopathology. You know, you walk into an ordinary shrink's office and you say, I have a voice in my head that's not mine. They're going to be concerned right off the bat, particularly traditionally. And what you find, of course, is if you look in the history of psychedelic experience, of esoteric experience, peculiar life, the peculiarities of life in general, and you're going to find yourself facing this question of voices in the head. And Terence McKenna being a perfectly good example. And of course, it can be very unpleasant to have voices in your head. There are, you know, deep in the throes of paranoid schizophrenia, these voices can be incredibly nasty, cruel, mocking. And so there are certainly reasons to be concerned, but we're living in an interesting age where, as with so many, supposed psychopathologies, that looked pretty clean and simple, from an earlier perspective, turn out to be a little bit more complicated. On the one hand, you have the hearing voices movement, which include a lot of people who hear voices, some of whom are pleasant and supportive, some of whom can be kind of cranky. But instead of pathologizing them and going to a shrink and saying, oh, my God, I'm screwed up, give me drugs, they instead create a cultural conversation among themselves and other more open-minded psychiatrists to come up with a way of just living with it, that it just becomes another feature of the wide diversity of neurological experience, you know, in this era where the idea of being neurotypical increases the idea that there's ways of being neuro-non-typical that aren't necessarily pathological. Other studies have also shown in a different regard how people can learn to treat the voices that happen in our heads all the time as potential others and potential selves. The idea here is that just sort of left on its own, the mind creates language, speech, concepts, ideas, injunctions, and that we learn to identify or disidentify with them. One great study that we've had her on the show is by Tanya Lerman, who wrote a book about the way that Christians, particularly ones with a sort of Pentecostal bent or an angle on Jesus, where the idea is that you can hear his voice, you can hear the God within you, that a lot of those experiences arise out of a way of learning how to treat certain kinds of voices in the head as coming from another source. And we don't look at that as pathology. So things become a lot more wiggy. And our guest today is going to take us in even further, more intriguing and esoteric dimension of this kind of phenomenon, which is not just about voices in the head, particularly with psychedelic experience, but languages in the head, and particularly alien languages or other languages, languages that seem to be recognizable, not recognizable, but on a continuum with our own tongues, with our own scripts, with our own ways of organizing reality into discrete semantic units. We're going to be talking with Diana Reed Slattery and her book, which just came out, is called Xenolinguistics. That means alien linguistics. Psychedelics, language, and the evolution of consciousness. And for my money, this is the most interesting and important book on psychedelics since Richard Doyle's Darwin's Pharmacy. We've had Rick on the show as well. And in a similar light, Benny Shannon's classic, The Antipodes of the Mind. It's a Diana's book is a sort of really a great combination of her own first-person accounts. She speaks very directly and very clearly about her own extraordinary experiences, and treats those experiences as you know, powerful phenomenological indicators of things that are really happening. And she also draws from a lot of experience reports. At the same time, there's a tremendous amount of really fascinating work on neurophenomenology, on the neurology of languages, on the history of alien languages and esotericism, and psychedelic experience, as well as some investigations of other artists like herself who have created artistic or other sorts of expressive ways of treating the languages that they have encountered in their own experiences. And probably one of these artists that's going to be familiar with to many of the listeners out there is Alison Gray, whose work has it kind of focuses often on these very curious cryptic lingo. So xenolinguistics is really quite a treat, and I read it as sort of an indication of the way that the discourse around psychedelics is going, where on the one hand there is a strong commitment to the brain towards models of understanding how symbols operate, how perception operates, embedded in a philosophically rigorous, critical way, and on the other hand, a very strong and direct engagement with personal experience, both by the writer and other contributors. And so it makes for a really wild and wonderful mix that I think at the very least forces us to take the phenomena of alien languages or otherworldly languages more seriously, which is it's long been an interest of mine, both inside and outside of psychedelic experience. Because as I said, you can also go back and like hearing voices, hearing languages, or seeing odd languages is a feature of many different esoteric and religious systems and records of experience. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation. But before we bring Diana onto the show, of course, our co-host here needs to be introduced, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
How about you? Do you have any? I know you're such a marvelous librarian of the esoteric. I was trying to think of non-psychedelic examples of alien or unusual languages, and could think of a few, but I'm sure that you've got some stored up there.
I mean, literally, there's never-ending ones of them. There's like here's my whole thing that I've kind of figured out through the course of my research, is there's like never-ending forms to be taken of languages and symbols that can be received by the human mind. And I think really what you nailed is the ability for discernment of those, right? Like, it's like, can we pick these up? I mean, like John Dee's Enochian alphabet is just one example of how there's been entire occult systems based off of an alien-received kind of language system, right? So we get these kind of things all the time in different forms in different cultures. And if you look at the occult material, it's kind of divided into two schools. There'll be people who say, learn to discern which voices are like, preferable over which ones you need to disregard, right? That's the whole like getting through schizophrenia. When you're schizophrenic, your ego receives and attaches ego meaning and interpretation to every symbol that's received ever, right? And then you have the Taoist way, which says ignore all of them, don't listen to anyone. And even like in higher levels of Kabbalah, to go back to John Dee, where like John Dee was receiving the Enochian alphabet and doing all the stuff that the angels said, or when people like listen to the aliens and do this stuff that they say, actually highest level Taoists and Kabbalists tell you don't listen to any angels or aliens or anybody. Think for yourself and go all the way to Ein Sof, which is what they call ineffable or beyond language or beyond symbols. So it seems like there's all these Zeno languages, but then there's also some kind of concept of like the place where all of those kind of evaporate. So
yeah, I was thinking of the one that's the most kind of fun because it's not always known to people is Mormonism. That there's one record we have of Joseph Smith's transcription of the language that the Book of Mormon was written in, because it was, of course, inscribed on these golden plates.
Yeah,
and if you've ever looked at the Book of Mormon, it's very long, and the golden plates weren't that long. So they were this dense alien code, and he had special glasses that he was able to decode the language by looking at them. But there is a record of some of the linguistic forms that he was seeing originally. And so there is a weird alien language at the heart of, you know, one of the strongest growing religions in America.
The whole Bible is an alien language. Moses receives the Bible from these extraterrestrial beings. So
yeah, but in that case, I don't think that there's an alien script so much.
Right.
That's where the real kind of oddity emerges is when.
Well, they say Hebrew letters were seen first as fire in the sky that was delivered by angels. So you could argue that Hebrew is an alien script if you want to get all like cuckoo.
Well, it's part of the dance is between cuckoo and not cuckoo, and I think Diana's done a wonderful job of balancing that edge thought in her book. So let's bring her on. Diana, welcome to Expanding Mind. Are you there? Hello? Oh,
hello.
Oh, good. So
hi.
Listen, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And I thought, since you do this in the book as well, that it obviously makes sense to start out with your own experience of the language that you developed and turned into a novel and software and all sorts of stuff that you've been working with for many years, Glide. And just tell us a little bit about what the circumstances of that download and how it really – Well, it really changed the course of your life and certainly of your work and creatively, intellectually. And so that seems like a good place to start.
Okay. Well, that was what I call it a download experience. One of those things where everything comes together all at once. You can, you know, in a very big, tight ball, and you can't really pull it apart. It takes years to pull it apart. So what happened was I was in Ireland, and I used to live there part of the time. And I had the intention to figure out what I was going to do my PhD thesis on. And what happened was what roared up in my mind was, no, you're going to write a novel. And it was like, oh, okay, do I have to do that first? Yeah. What is it about? And so I got started outlining this novel, and this entire story world was there. And it was clear enough in the story world to go enter the story world and talked to the people in it, the characters who were forming, and the general population. And then I knew it was about a game. And so I asked the question, well, how is the game played? And that turned out to be a very critical question, because the download came as, you know, a single line. The game is played on mazes made of the visual language Glide. And then the whole language appeared, and all the glyphs and all the implications and everything that, you know, finally became the book Xenolinguistics after it became the novel. I worked the whole thing out in a novel form in the maze game, and then went on to kind of take that phenomena of these linguistic phenomena that occur to people in psychedelic spaces especially, and research it, find out what else was happening. was I the only sufficiently weird person to have these experiences, or or, you know, was it more general? It turned out to be somewhat more general, and that's about what happened.
Well, certainly one of the differences is that I think a lot of people, certainly in psychedelic experience, have a sense of very complex sort of matrices of information or data, which can be encoded in some kind of hieroglyphic form or some kind of otherworldly script. But I think it's relatively rare, and you tell me if I'm wrong, for people to come back, so to speak, with a whole glyph system intact, that's a less likely experience. And I'm just kind of curious for you, how clear was that? You know, so you see these glyphs in some, you know, far out state. And then how did those translate? How easy was it for you to capture those, and bring them into our world, to scribble them down on a piece of paper, to know that you had sort of gotten them?
Well, actually, it was very easy. I was not on any kind of altered state from a substance. I was in an altered state creatively, you could say. And the state just kept going on for quite a while. And but that very first writing down of the glyphs, I saw, it's like the system revealed itself in its core of, you know, it was a mathematical kind of thing. It's made of three strokes, so it wasn't any problem to write it all down once I had the key as to, you know, what it was. It just sort of came, and then the meanings shone forth from the glyphs, and the glyphs sort of, they were like a self-instructing kind of language. You know, once I had the glyphs, and then they started showing me how to arrange them in mazes, how to make them into three-dimensional objects, and that kind of thing. Now, Alison Gray is another good example of someone who brought an entire symbol system through and has been working with it for years. She calls it secret language. And I write quite a bit about that in the book as well. And she wrote the foreword for the book, and she talks about her experience with this kind of symbol system.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's already a number of prongs to the whole research. One involves art, not just using art to express these peculiar languages, but there's something in the creativity itself, in the creative urge that relates to these kinds of languages. It's no accident that the people who come across them seem to cluster around people who want to play with them creatively and aesthetically, in novels, in software, in painting especially, as well as just sort of investigating them. It seems like it's interesting that there's something about the creativity of language itself that seems to be part of the phenomenon, as well as the kind of more scientific or formal or mathematical questions that are raised by these complicated systems.
Oh, I think we go right, when these parts of the brain, mind, whatever you want to call it, consciousness, are contacted, are stirred, there's really, a deep language-making facility that exists in all of us. And somehow, some way, sometimes it gets stirred. And I think maybe it gets stirred when we're in the middle of an experience that is totally inexpressible. You know, this means, some means of expression is so necessary that it just wells forth. It just comes out, and comes out. You know, one of the forms that you see it in is, the very familiar form of glossolalia. People go into altered states, and that's what comes out of them, is a language that makes sense to them, but is not necessarily, anything like natural languages. And
well, you raise that question of natural languages, and I think one of the first things that comes to people's mind is you could say, well, great, I got some weird squiggles that seem to have some kind of coherence to them, but, how do I know that this isn't just a bunch of images of glyphs that don't have any connection? And in your experience, the glyphs weren't just visual. They were also associated with certain kinds of words or concepts. And then, just rising to the larger question of, do these things become actual natural languages? I mean, I know that in occult history that Enochian John Dee's language does right. have the structure of natural language, that it is a language. And what that actually means, you know, is a complicated question. So when you were looking at these examples in your own life and then the other people's who you're talking about, how does that kind of play out in terms of, are these quote unquote real languages or are they just symbol systems?
Well, I you know, we'd have to really get into what we mean by real language or what we mean by symbol system. And I go back and forth between calling them languages and symbol systems and things like that. They're all linguistic to me. As far as natural language, the way I use it refers to, you know, all the languages on planet Earth that we speak and use, and they all, you know, they have a certain structure, and that's what's studied in linguistics. And I started calling these languages unnatural languages because they just don't fit the natural language pattern. They don't, these simple systems, I haven't run across one where there's some kind of subject-object structure, where there's a dualistic structure. In fact, I started to think about natural language and the, you know, the way it embeds dualism in the subject-object structure and many other ways, and that somehow that natural languages, the naturalness of them comes from the fact that we live in a gravity well. And I think that that gravity is what actually – gravity is one of the factors because it's such a primary way that we orient. We orient our bodies and we orient our minds to this gravity well, which is a dualistic up-down thing. We get up-down very, very, you know, from the beginning because we're a life form. And that structures our language and that structures our logic into these dualistic pairs. It's just very, quote-unquote, natural. And that some of these languages act as if they are not from gravity wells or not from states of mind that are associated with gravity.
Right. That's
they're weightless in some ways. And then you get a very different kind of logic when you are looking and observing and perceiving from a 360-degree standpoint, let's say. From a very spacious 360-degree, not looking through eyeballs, not responding to up and down as much.
I like that idea of weightless languages. And that experience that you're talking about also seems to be involved with this motif that we find, again, in both psychedelic and other kinds of visionary experience of the contact with the other, this idea that there's some sort of contact or communication. And that in this contact with something ineffable, extraordinary, outside of the known, alien, that it's almost as if these languages arise as the interface between a more familiar world, which is being unwoven by the visionary experience, and this incoming other. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of that kind of language about contacting the other in regards to these fabulous languages?
Well, I think contacting the other is central, and the response and the fact that it is an interface, it's a means to navigate that experience and to make it one to be able to bring it home in some form and to have that communication in something other than natural language with you know, or complete ineffable feeling, you know, with that whatever form we see the other in. You see, in our you know, contemporary Western culture, the other has been fairly well banished from polite conversation. And you know, it tends to, you know, when people assert that they're in communication with some kind of other in their baseline state, they you know, they run certain risks of, you know, psychiatric evaluation. But a great number of other cultures, and especially, of course, indigenous cultures, what's left of them, have lots of traffic with the other. You know, in other words, the kami in Japan, the spirits that one runs into in shamanic experiences, you know, all of this, you know, most of our human history has dealt with communications with the other, at least specialists, you know, who could do that, whether it was shamans or priests or whatever, and now we don't have that, but the phenomena is alive and well. I mean, it just pops up, and we get to it through psychedelic experience quite easily, through meditative experience, other things too.
Well, you've mentioned practices, and I really appreciate the way that you start out the book talking about practice and the idea of psychonautic practice, that it's not just a roll in the druggy hay, that there's a kind of intentionality that's brought to these experiences that can help enrichen and kind of complexify them almost. So could you just talk a little bit about the way in which the protocols and the intentionality that people bring to these experiences can help stage the kinds of encounters that you're talking about?
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that, because it's primary to how I use psychedelics and how I think they can be used. I in no way think it's the only way to use it, but they can be used for these kind of investigations. And these investigations, they're not just intellectual investigations. They're like whole person investigations. You stick your whole self out there on the line every time you go, and you better bring it all, and you better acknowledge it all, or you're going to have trouble along the way. But doing this kind of thing as a repeated praxis, exactly, where you go, you do this over and over, and it's a developmental thing. It changes, just like you start playing the violin, it sounds pretty dreadful, you know, but if you keep it up and you have, you know, some intention, you have a few teachers along the way, pretty soon you can make some decent sounds. But it takes practice. You know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. And this is like doing things over and over, noticing what's happening, correcting your mistakes, getting informed by the experience of others. And you know, everything you can do to bring to these experiences, but then, you know, familiarity occurs, and you know, you start to see landmarks, and you start to be able to navigate a bit, and that's saying quite a lot, because most of the experiences I have are not predictable in that sense, which is also part of it. It's like going into a practice, going into a session, let's call it a psychedelic session, where you don't really know what's going to happen. You can have a clear intention of what you want to say. I want to examine my relationship with my Uncle Bob, you know, and you go in and it's like, no, that's not really what we had in mind. And you know, you go off on in some other direction, or whatever that intention was gets dealt with immediately. And then now it's okay, let's go have some fun. So it's very hard to say.
Yeah. It also seems that you run into this question of whether how much you can share between people, between in whether in books or in conversations. You know, there's some models where you're kind of going into your own particular world, and it's very singular and unique to you. You know, the languages that you're going to see aren't going to be the same as somebody else's. But there's also this drive to understand and to develop a common language. And in traditional societies, that common language is provided by the mythology, by the ways that animals are named, and the spirits are sort of mapped according to culturally shared maps. And it's, oh yes, you saw the praying mantis. Oh yes, well, there's a whole lore about the praying mantis. In the West, now we're at this weird place where there's not that many common languages. So some people draw from indigenous sources, or they look towards aliens or the occult tradition as a sort of model and map. But another thing that can be done, which isn't done enough in my opinion, and that you do very wonderfully in your book, is to look at science, to look at what can we learn from the way that the brain works, or ways that we've understood how languages have worked historically, or different ways that people have thought about some of these edge experiences in pretty concrete scientific terms, not to turn the visionary experience over to the scientists to get their approval or to get their disapproval, as it more often is the case, but instead to use that language as well as a kind of common tongue. To understand some of these ineffable and bizarre experiences, and you do that in a number of ways in the book, but just to sort of start out, you look at some of these neurophenomenological models, try to understand how perception works, but particularly how language functions in terms of perception. So when you were looking at all these kinds of different theories, I'm sure there's a whole universe of theories out there about this stuff. What were some of the ones, or some of the first ones, where you went, aha, this is going to be helpful for my project? This is one that I really want to work with.
Well, I think that came in the discovery that there was a discipline called neurophenomenology. And it's not very popular, and it never really went anywhere, but there it is. And there was a man named Charles Laughlin, or Laughlin, and with some colleagues wrote a book on this. And what the essence of neurophenomenology is to try to match or relate, correlate in some way the internal phenomenology of the experience, in other words, the report of the direct experience that a person is having, with the neurological brain data, you know, things that are happening, and try to make some kind of a connection between those two. And they do a fairly good job, because they investigate indigenous experience. They mention psychedelic experience, and they also, especially for Laughlin, was based in, you know, a mature contemplative practice. So he was familiar with, you know, different mind states. And they make the point that it's a very cultural matter what mind states are acceptable to any given culture. And, you know, if it's an acceptable thing that, you know, on Friday nights, the shaman goes off into other worlds and comes back with some, you know, cures or deals with that particular spirit that is bothering me. That's a different kind of acceptance than you might find, you know, in North America, in our current state. That would be weird.
Well, okay, so
that's neurophenomenology in a nutshell. There's one other thing. There's a term that is used, and I'm sorry, I can't come up with the particular scientist, but there was an effort to make neuronal conscious correlates. In other words, to somehow make these maps between brain activity and subjective activity. I go fairly deeply into that, and I think they do a good job of it. But again, it never encompasses the magnitude of the visionary experience, whether it's psychedelic or contemplative or whatever. It always feels terrifically, however well ordered, it's terrifically reductionist.
Yeah.
There's just no getting around that.
Well, great. We have to take a break right now. We got more questions to ask you. We're speaking with Diana Slattery here on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. I'm here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Diana Slattery about xenocommunication and xenolinguistics. Diana, a little bit before the break, you were talking about some efforts of controlling some of the languages, or like seeing which one is appropriate versus inappropriate, and also mentioning how important it is to make contact with and receive those languages. But for the listeners, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of your discoveries or experiences with the discernment of those. So, like, if we look through the history of, you know, humanity, certainly we can find a lot of individuals that claim to be receiving these, you know, other alien, non-natural languages, and then they'll use those in efforts to sort of, like, do things that maybe aren't the best. Like, even to use the earlier example of John Dee with the Enochian, for example, part of what the stuff that his partner, Edward Kelly, said the angel language was saying was that he should be able to have sex with John Dee's wife. So, what is a good way for people to get that discernment? Would it literally be what you were referring to earlier with just like practice and using techniques? Or like, how do you know you're not just kind of listening to some gnarly alien overlord?
Well, exactly. I mean, Terence McKenna used to discuss this problem at length. You know, in other words, don't take everything you hear with you know, utter credulity. It's right. Ridiculous. You have to be able to discern shit from shinola. Okay, it's that simple. If you can't do that in your daily life, you're probably not going to be able to do that very well in this psychedelic life. And that comes from, I don't know what that comes from, you know, good sense, good living. The D and Kelly example is magnificent, because, you know, there they were traveling Europe, you know, from court to court, you know, with their divination shtick.
Right.
And you know, trying to get money out of the, you know, to support themselves. And they were the crazy magician, I don't know what to call it. Dee was a very legitimate guy. I mean, had this enormous library in England,
he was
consulted by the Queen, and you know, somehow he gets caught up with, you know, with Kelly and Enochian results.
I just consider
another ripping good invention.
Right?
You know, something on the order of the experiment at La Chorrera or something.
Well, that's a good example, because even though McKenna is a really interesting case, because on the one hand he maintained a lot of skepticism even as he went into these very far out places and spoke from a certain kind of pragmatic skepticism about psychedelic experience, but at the same time he also had his own kind of, if you will, sort of religious moment when, you know, he downloads a very complex system. It's not quite a language. It's this mathematical object, this idea, this intuition about time that then he develops into the time wave. You know, he kind of literalizes or mathematizes into this time wave zero figure. And, you know, that's still pretty interesting or whatever. And then he decides to lay it onto actual historical time and to further literalize the experience with a final date, with saying that this whole thing is going to end. You can map it onto ordinary history, and you can look forward to this marvelous date in December of 2012, which he also fudged a little bit in terms of once he found out about the Mayan calendar. He changed it a little bit. To my mind, that is an example of the slippery slope. Of the place where the download, the La Chorrera experience is richly played with, rich ideas about the resonance factor in time and the I Ching and other, you know, marvelous speculative models get played out. But then there's also this sort of drive to bring it down. And it's interesting because there's a difference between concretizing the download in a language that can be played with artistically in terms of novels, in terms of paintings, in terms of just the playfulness that's invited through the language. There's a difference between that and the other kind of literalizing, where it becomes sort of, there's an element of messianic thinking,
which is exactly what it is.
And that's in some ways the great, to my mind, that's the single greatest trap of whatever psychedelic thinking in terms of actually trying to extract information or bring back new models from these visionary experiences is the tendency to become inflated, to believe that your vision is the vision, the one, da 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 da. So I'm curious, since you definitely don't go that way, how have you come to think about that possibility and to really work against it in some ways? I mean, what are, as part of a psychedelic protocol, it seems there are certain ways of thinking critically or skeptically, or I'm not really even sure what the right word is. How would you clarify that trap and how to avoid it?
Well, that's a good one.
It's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one. How, I mean, you gotta know it in yourself. You gotta know if something like that is occurring. But the way I look at it, I have a framework that I look at it in, and I also remind me to come back to John Lilly's framework for evaluating that kind of thing, which is that we can access multiple realities. And what's going on in another reality is what's going on in that reality. And I can go to a reality where I feel I am in touch with all the knowledge in the Akashic records or wherever the hell it's all stored. And, you know, I can reach out to anything. And that's a psychedelic experience that many people have had. If I come back to baseline and I think I can just exercise that in an unlimited state, that, you know, there's something to be looked at there. And the same with getting, it's the inflation factor. It can happen as a result of any kind of super big, consciousness experience, however attained. And you just got to kind of get a hold of yourself, and you have to recognize when it's happening. And you see these giant flame wars, online and in the psychedelic world of some, one visionary, guru who's, he's got it made, and the other one is arguing with him, and they just go at it because, each one thinks they're king of the universe. And it just gets pretty silly. And you got to be able to see the silliness of it, I think. You have to, it's just like, not that those experiences aren't just as big and bigger than they're even able to express, but then it's like the discernment comes in what reality are you operating in, and what are the rules of that reality, and what are the boundaries of that reality? And then, again, you use the word appropriateness, and what's an appropriate statement in this kind of situation? So anyhow, it's an ongoing work in progress. But the back to the whole thing of praxis, what comes out of that, I think, is hopefully some kind of tempering of one's knowledge and one's communication of that knowledge, and you learn something by experience. So anyhow, I think using psychedelics in as a practice in whatever way. Some people use it in small groups, as in a ritual, ceremonial way. There are folks around who are still using Timothy Leary's psychedelic prayers, pieces of that, which is based on the Tao Te Ching, to center, to guide their experience. So, there's a million ways to do that, do this practice. And we're all, when you solo, you're rolling your own, you're figuring out your own practice as you go along. And I think that's, I consider it kind of a form of citizen science. And, if you're going to take psychedelics, and we know they're still illegal, and some of them are, some of them aren't. And if you're going to do that, do it mindfully, to use that word. Do it with some intention in mind. Do it with some record keeping. Do it to learn something and to be able to communicate that learning to others.
Yeah, that's where I really, again, like not just the content of your book, but just the your decision to move between, you know, registers where you take extraordinary, bizarre experiences very seriously as indicating something deeper, something more objective even, about our, at least the way our own minds operate in these states. But then also, you know, taking the time to look at neuroscience and to look at philosophy, like you take Francisco Varela's enactionist ideas very seriously. A couple of weeks ago, we had Evan Thompson on the show, and there's a great deal of similarity there. And that seems to me that what's partly necessary is there has to be kind of an environment. You know, there's not a psychedelic university. These things are discussed in the underground or in weird ways in the science because they can't actually go into that much phenomenology and be taken seriously. So there's this whole kind of Wild West zone where it's very easy for inflation to happen, where it's very easy for the person who's always wanted to be the one who knows to come back and say, now I do know.
I really got it.
And you're going to hear all about it. And so instead, it's not just about being an individual citizen scientist is what I'm saying. It's about having and sustaining these networks of conversation that create an environment where people recognize that they can do very far out explorations, you know, taking the risks that involves both legally and psychologically, but that there's also a sort of a network ready to catch them that's not simply either a specific religious idea of what these things mean, like in Santo Daime, nor it's just a bunch of individuals who have who are clutching onto their own particular vision, but instead a kind of collaborative environment where people are sharing and with a little bit more humility about what we can know and what we can't know. So I hope that happens more. I'm curious, where do you see that happening? How do you feel about this sort of larger world of psychedelic discourse in terms of, you know, moving ahead of where it's been in the past?
Wow. well, there's a lot of snake oil out there, like you say, and you know, how much one wants to sample is you know, up to the individual. But I think I see it evolving enormously with the many fora that exist, Reddit and, you know, all these kind of places where there's ongoing lively discussion and plenty of, plenty of people with nice pins to punch balloons, you know, and you know, so that kind of discussion, well, that's been going on ever since we had bulletin boards on the, you know, before we even had the internet. But that kind of, I really want to talk about something, and I want to talk about it enough to go find the others who are talking about it, happens, and it happens on all kinds of social media. I think the amount of information that's getting out there now through websites and more so through podcasts, through what you're doing, through what Lorenzo is doing with Matrix Masters, through, you know, other examples of, you know, just getting the information out, letting people sort things out for themselves. And the more that gets out there, the better. You know, I have a PhD in xenolinguistics. You know, there's not exactly a lot of tenure track positions open at universities in xenolinguistics. But if there ever is, I'll be there. You know, it's just it's a world that's forming. You know, we now there are courses in, you know, Tom Roberts has had his course for years and years, and now he's retired. But you know, things are advancing on. There's a tremendous new interest in psychedelics that I see blossoming through the science, through the experiences. There's two HBO projects which are upcoming. that, you know, none of them are settled, but it looks like Timothy Leary is going to have his own little miniseries, and it looks like Stan Grof might as well. And that HBO is interested in this kind of programming in addition to, you know, shoot 'em ups is a positive thing.
Yeah, I think we're definitely moving into a space where these kinds of conversations and possibilities are going to be taken more seriously, and not just as cultural things, because, you know, in a way, consumer capitalism loves to absorb the edges, the fringes, because it gives it new material. But it's not just that, I think. I think that there's a deeper sense that the edges of the mind are as integral to what we're exploring now as the more familiar domains, and that since psychedelics have this weird effect of simultaneously being, you know, physical compounds that we can talk about and we can look at, you know, as, you know, metabolically is something that passes through the human system, and at the same time are so striking in their attendant phenomena, that they're a very good place to sort of play with both the limits of science and the expansion of science, or the expansion of knowledge around that. I'm curious, of all the sort of languages you discovered looking at other people's work. We already talked about Alison Gray, and I think people know her. Who else really stands out for you as doing something or having had a particularly interesting experience that you talk about in your book? Because you do talk about a number of artists and their own discovered languages. We only have a few minutes left, but there's time for
okay.
that.
Okay. Well, two of the most interesting ones that I encountered, one is Jason Tucker, who is an artist, a painter. He spent many years working for George Lucas, doing the Clone Wars and all kinds of animation editing. And he had a period in Los Angeles of some duration where he was doing a lot of mushrooms. And it was a contact experience for him when he would draw. In the be mushroomed state, he would sense another being on the other side of the drawing who was drawing it with him. And by doing this drawing together, they brought the being into existence, into a representational form. And so it was like this constant communication activity. He calls it actual contact. And the other one I love that is up on the website is a French couple who took Carolyn and Gaetan Cottereau-Muro, and they did one project where they took Pergamum Harmala every day for a year, both of them, and she designed this incredible drawing, which is filled with everything. It's a temple floor. It's scripts. It's full of language, and eventually tattooed the entire thing on his back. And it's just, you know, it's an amazing creation. And anyhow, that's two of them, and they're very different. You know, one from the next. But there's
absolutely.
There's a lot out there. And when you put your own work out there and you ask these questions and people contact you, that's what happened. You know, it's just Jason, you know, contacted me, and these guys I ran into in a conference, you know. It just happens. You make the contacts and then they're very strong.
So I know you've been working on this project for a very long period of time. And as you say, there's not a lot of tenure track positions in xenolinguistics out there. do you have some sense about where you're going with this stuff now? Which direction you want to write or create or talk, or what's the kind of next step?
The next step is there's three books I'd like to write, and I just a question of which one pops up first. And one is I want to write the second novel that follows the Maze Game, and wraps in my current experience with the novel world. And then I also want to write some kind of a memoir about my crazy life. And, you know, I realize when I tell stories to people that, I entertain them. I say, oh, okay, I must live my life to entertain others. Just, you know, that's one aspect of it. So why not have fun and, you know, write it all down and have chapters like Confessions of a Cult Leader's Wife and things like that. So there's that project. And then... And then the third is, you know, kind of an ongoing, this isn't so much a book, but I'm back loaded on the number of people who have contacted me with incredible their own xenolinguistic projects, which I want to get up on my website, and that's pretty important to me right now.
Wonderful. Whichever one of those you pursue, I'm sure it'll be marvelous. I also wanted to mention that people can check out more about your stuff at your website, Psychedelics and Language, which is a pretty nifty site with lots of information and cool graphics and such, in addition to your new book. So, Diana, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, Eric.
All right. Well, for me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.